Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line 1, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Can sports be made more appealing and more rewarding for all children and teens who would like to participate? Is the focus on winning good or bad for professional athletes, high-quality athletes, and for recreational sports participants? How important is the mental aspect of competitive athletics? We'll be addressing questions like these and those that you would like to have answered with today's guest, Mayo Clinic sports psychologist, Dr. Max Trinari. He's joining us by telephone today from his office in Rochester, Minnesota, and you can reach us with your questions and comments. In Anchorage, our local number is 550-8433. Our toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752. Our email address is the usual one, line1@alaskapublic.org. Dr. Trinari is a sports medicine psychologist at the Mayo Clinic. He's the psychology consultant for the U.S. Youth Soccer Region 2, and he's also a youth soccer coach himself. Dr. Trinari, thanks so much for taking the time to be with us today.
Oh, you're welcome. My pleasure.
Let's start by some general questions about sports in general for kids. Why is it important for kids to think about doing some sports activities?
Well, in general, just for health reasons, and I think that we hear about this all over the news these days, of course, that we all need to be a bit more active. And this is a great way to keep our kids healthy. It's a great way to socialize. It's a great way to learn about problem solving in a creative way if we coach them the right way.
When I look at some of the information that you've written about and talked about as far as keeping kids interested in sports, I notice that you promote, if I'm quoting you right, three key ideas. Those are choice, competence, and caring. Could we ask you to kind of flesh that out a little bit better?
Sure. And it's not just me that promotes that. This is based on some good science and theory that's been developed over a few decades now, I think. And these concepts are ones that we use here in Minnesota when we provide education to soccer parents and soccer coaches. So these basic ideas of providing kids with an environment where they feel like they belong, and that may be belonging to a group or belonging to an important relationship, maybe with a coach, where they feel like they're good at something, so that they're competent and becoming better at that or becoming more competent, and where they have choices, where it's their choice to engage in the activity, and they can even have choices about how to perform the activity. And if you have those three factors going for you, you'll have someone who is motivated to engage in whatever that activity is about. We all need those three things to be motivated to pursue an activity.
So we have that ability to have some kind of choice, try to work towards some confidence in this, and while we're working at it, we're getting some feeling that someone's caring about us, which kind of meets our some other psychological needs, is what I'm hearing you say.
Yeah, and again, we all need this, and the research on this pretty clearly shows that these factors aren't just for sports, they're for all of us in the work world and elsewhere. And you know, the typical boiled down answer is that kids participate in sports for fun, which I like to think is certainly true. There are kids that are put in situations where they're essentially forced to participate in the sport. They've been signed up, and sometimes kids really didn't want to be there. And that's going to be a situation that isn't going to benefit them. But if they're, again, given the option to participate, and when we coach them, if we even give them options about how they figure out a problem in the game that we're coaching, about how they perform the activity, they'll be more motivated to pursue it. We all have to have these things.
The focus on fun and your when you alluded to the fact that it's true in the workplace as well as just general parenting advice makes me think about it. Years ago, I used to do some parenting classes, and after doing several parenting classes, which we had a hard time getting anybody to pay for, but we were all very appreciative. It made me realize that the business people spend lots and lots and lots of high dollars learning the same thing about how to get more out of employees and get them to do what they wanted to do. So I can understand what you're saying.
Well, I think it's a little bit like a spiral staircase sometimes, and we hope that we're always going up, but it seems like we're going round and round and relearning the same thing, hopefully at, shall we say, a little higher level.
So if we're, let's try to get some specific advice about getting kids interested in sports, being successful in sports, enjoying sports, having fun, as you said. How do we do that?
Well, there's a big question. There probably isn't an instant, easy answer to that one. I think that some of this comes down to the roles that we all play in youth sports. For example, when coaches are working with the kids, one of their major roles is to provide kids with a chance to learn and become more competent. Now, that's not to say that the coach isn't going to provide a lot of caring and foster a sense of belonging as well. And they're certainly going to give kids lots of autonomy or lots of choices. As I said again, I coach soccer, and so we try and give players different ideas about how to solve problems in the game and then let them figure that out. And sometimes it's a matter of standing back. So, for example, maybe this is jumping ahead in something that you wanted to talk about, but when kids are playing their game, whatever that may be, it's not uncommon to hear a lot of advice from the sideline, for example, and or yelled from the crowd. And for kids, if they're being told what to do, it's effectively telling them that they need to be told what to do. So if we can let them play and just learn as they play, maybe with a little information from the coach now and again, that will enhance their sense of competency and choice. And it's easy to come up with some of these examples that we've heard about in the news, I think, where coaches or parents or other athletes have been out of line. We just want to give the kids the opportunity to figure things out on their own. And so coaches pointing things out to the kids, if they can do that in a way that doesn't necessarily point out the mistake so much as point out what the athlete has done well. And I like to, when I lecture to coaches, suggest to them that they try to ask the athlete what they can add to what they've already done well.
So what I, in a sense, what I'm hearing is I've been one of those parents on the sideline. I've been among other parents on the sideline in girls soccer. And it's letting, and I'm also a parent, so at the same time, from a general parenting standpoint, we don't want our kids to fail. We want to do everything we can to help them be successful. And so we fall into this trap, as I hear you saying, of telling them how they should act, how they should do things. And at times, not always, at times it may be best to let them make a mistake, learn from that mistake, talk to them about how to rationalize or figure out how to act better or how they should have responded better. And that will stay with them more. They'll learn more from that opportunity, and they may get the positive reinforcement of figuring it out on themselves. Am I overstating what you said or misstating?
No, thanks. You said it better than I just did.
No, I didn't mean to do that, but I wanted to make sure I understood what you were saying.
No, well done. Well done. Thanks for that. Yeah, I think to put it another way, and I was talking with a colleague of mine who was writing an article for Soccer America, or I believe it was, and I think that, of course, parents and coaches are extremely invested in the kids. You know, whether you're in that role of training them as a coach, or you're in the role of taking care of your child and wanting the very best for them, of course, and you want to see them succeed. We want to see our kids get good grades. We want them to get A's, and we want to give them all the chances that we can. Mm-hmm. And when we get into sports, or for that matter, school sometimes, we struggle, and I've struggled with this because I've got two kids who have both played soccer. We struggle with allowing them to experience some adversity and letting them experience that adversity more or less on their own. Now, as I recall, you're a pediatrician.
That's correct.
So you appreciate the idea of staging this in a developmental fashion, so we might not let the 6-year-old experience adversity in the same way that we'd let the 16-year-old experience adversity, and we might provide support in a different way. So one, let the kids have the option of figuring out the game on their own. Let them experience some adversity, because the game won't always go their way, and they will learn how to deal with it. And yeah, on the touch line, if it's soccer, or on the sideline, or from the stands, advising the athletes will diminish their sense of competency, their sense of choice, and their sense of being cared about. When I talk to parents or coaches, I'll talk to them about cheering, and I'll define a cheer as something positive that's said. And it's said after the fact, so to speak, after the play is made. And it's also something that isn't prescriptive. So it's not telling the athlete what to do. And preferably, it's something that's said when the action that has taken place was obviously good. So my favorite example of this is the 15-year-old soccer player who has crossed the ball to the other side of the pitch only to go to the opposing defender who starts a counterattack and scores. Mm-hmm. And it's not uncommon, actually, to see or hear people get very excited about the ball being crossed, but the next thing that happens a split second later is that the counterattack occurs. So the 15-year-old will turn around and look at the crowd, or pick out whoever said that and look at them in, shall we say, kind of a cross way. Because it obviously wasn't a good thing.
Right.
And there are times when you can't tell if something really good is happening. And I suggest to people sometimes, well, don't say anything for a bit. That's hard to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm going to take just 1 second and remind listeners you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. Our topic today is sports psychology. We're fortunate to have on the line Mayo Clinic sports psychologist, Dr. Max Trenary. If you've got questions or comments about sports psychology, getting kids interested in staying with sports and activities, why don't you give us a call? Our local number is 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752, and our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. Again, our local number, 550-8433. You know, when I remember at some point getting interested in what made good coaches, probably at some time when my kids were playing, and, you know, John Wooten was certainly one of the most successful coaches. He was a basketball coach. And I remember, and again, our memories are not perfect, but my remembrances, he really didn't stress putting pressure on kids. He wanted them to feel, willing to take the chance, not have the stress that they're going to make a mistake. And so worrying about mistakes also, it seems to me, for many kids, it leads to poorer performance in the long run. And so how we structure this reinforcement, this positive attitude, this fun of playing, can also increase the quality of the play in the long run. Is there evidence to support that kind of idea?
Yeah, I think there is, and at least anecdotally, when I work with our Olympic Development Program soccer players, and I work with those coaches, one of the things that I talk with them about is automatic language, and I think you're very correct to mention mistake management, because that's what a lot of the athletes I see struggle with. And when I mention automatic language, there are a couple of components to that, because athletes typically know, especially by the time they hit adolescence, they know when something has gone wrong, when they've made a mistake, when things aren't going their way. They're keenly aware of it. And in working with some of these players and going through mental skills training with them and exercises, some of the words that they instantly come up with in response to their own mistake are beyond harsh. I've worked with young men that will call themselves names, it's instantaneous the moment they know that it's gone wrong. And the words that they come up with, let's just say that they weren't born with them. Somebody had to say that. Somebody had to say the word to get it in there.
Right.
And so in doing mental skills training with them, I end up using some information from cognitive theory and cognitive therapy to try and get them past that so that they appreciate that these are automatic thoughts, and we start teaching them how to refocus on what they really believe in. And it can make a difference for them. But yeah, the first thing is that those words got in there because somebody said something to them somewhere. They've learned that. And the other component of automatic language that I like to focus on with them is the idea of using and or but in a sentence. And a lot of us in coaching, and I've done this, a lot of us in coaching were trained in the sandwich method. And when we give feedback to an athlete, we're trained to say, "That was a really great run, Jimmy, but next time get your head up with the ball, and then you can make that great pass." And by using the conjunction but, I've just negated the great stuff I've told Jimmy. Mm-hmm. I've told him he has a great run, except that it's not a great run because he didn't get his head up to make a pass. And so if I can tell him that's a fantastic run that you've made, and next time get your head up and get your pass off, and that'll be fantastic. Mm-hmm. Going through this with soccer players, they immediately recognize the difference in how that feels. Mm-hmm. We're overtrained in it, I think, and we sort of become numb to it, except it does start to detract from performance.
We have a caller, but I can't help but want to, as a pediatrician, want to relate that to parenting as well. So you could take the same idea when Johnny does something wrong at home and how we address what he's done wrong to help him do it right next time. How we say it has a lot to do with how he feels about himself.
Yeah. No, it's, as I like to say, it's the same thing, only different.
Jason, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Thank you. I'm just curious if there's any correlation or evidence to support maybe a family culture of sports. If the parents are participants in a sport themselves, are the children more likely to carry on and stick with those sports or other sports as they grow older?
Okay, good question.
It is a good question. Part of it's going to depend on the type of culture that that is happening, shall we say. And yes, there is some correlation with the idea that family athleticism, I think, will help foster the child's athleticism. Again, a lot of it is going to have to do with how that is transmitted. I can give you a really personal example. As I said, I've had a couple of kids that played soccer. One of them went on to play D3 soccer, and she was a very good goalkeeper. The other one, after a while, said, you know, I just don't care for this anymore. And he said he wanted to run cross-country. I said, fantastic. So that was a bit of a twist for me, because I had played some soccer as I grew up. And my wife looked at me and wondered how I would take that. My concern was that the kids were active. So if the family culture is such that it promotes athleticism and involvement in sport and competition, and especially if it promotes the ideas of training in athletic activity for the sake of the activity itself. And we can talk a lot about intrinsic motivation, but if it fosters that sense of intrinsic motivation, that this is something that I just want to do for the sheer joy of the activity, I think that kind of family environment can really pass on a great gift to kids that will be passed on to future generations.
Jason, Jason, did that address your question, or did you want to be more specific?
Oh no, that was right, exactly what I was curious about. I appreciate that information. Thank you.
Thank you, Max. When you said it depended, you started the answer to that question on the type of culture. What were you implying there?
Sure. Yeah. Well, and I'm a psychologist, so I'm at risk for saying it depends. Yeah, thanks for the laugh. That was funny. Coming back to the idea of intrinsic motivation and the three factors that you mentioned, the ideas of belonging or caring, competency, and choice, all these things lead to or foster intrinsic motivation. And if kids are in an environment where they are participating in the activity partly just because it feels good physically. Then another component of this that goes into the competency part or component of this is the idea of what goal are they pursuing. And especially with young kids, when we coach, we want to foster this idea of self-referenced competency, which sounds very fancy. And all that means is, for example, for the soccer player who's maybe 7 years old, going out in the backyard with the ball and juggling and seeing how many more touches they can get than the last time and setting their own records. Not compared to anybody else, just compared to them. And we want to foster that kind of development all the way through their career, because that's the kind of interest in the activity, just the curiosity of wondering, can I get a little bit better than I was yesterday? And having the question in mind, I've been able to do certain things, can I add to that just a little bit? And if we can get people doing that, it's going to help keep them active, I think. So we've got to foster that kind of development, whether it's in the family, schools, our coaches, we want to have foster that.
Yeah. That gets to this idea of, in my mind at least, of not making winning the end point, the success, because you're not always going to win. You can't always control winning. No matter how good you are, you can get beat. but you can
right.
control your effort, your attempts to, as you said, be masterful or to improve what you're doing, which I think also along the way improves the likelihood of having good motivation versus losing, which you may not control but can neglect from the motivation, and then things stop moving positively towards fun and success.
or happiness.
Yeah, and I think what you're doing there is drawing the distinction between, or the juxtaposition of between focused on the win and focused on the result versus what you need to be able to do that. And right. It's very hard to hold both of them at the same time. If the athletes and the coaches and the parents start focusing on the next win, they've just missed the game that's in front of them, to put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll see athletes come unfocused, and coaches for that matter, come unfocused sometimes. And it's easy for any of us to do because we start thinking ahead. You know, if it's baseball, maybe you start thinking of the next inning. If it's tennis, start thinking of the next set. If it's soccer, you start thinking of the 90th minute. And in doing so, you've left that moment that you're in, and by definition, you're unfocused at that point.
Right.
So if we can have the athlete focused on what they're doing and what they're about just then, which is some of the work that I do with our soccer players, it actually helps keep some of the criticisms at bay, keeps them in the game, so to speak, mentally. And oddly enough, they'll get a better result from it.
Mm-hmm. You know, I'm jumping ahead a little bit, and I want to spend most of this first half on just general advice about keeping kids happy and in sports and relating it to parenting. And there's some other questions I have, but it all automatically jumps to the correlation with professional sports as much. And golf is something that I follow a lot right now. And you hear golfers all the time say they kind of lost their focus. And I think that almost gets to where you're talking, is you stop focusing on what it is right now. You're thinking about the future. You're thinking about the past, things that you don't have much control over, but you have control over staying in the moment, so to speak. And is that what the pros are talking about when they're talking about focus?
I suspect that that's what they're getting at.
Uh-huh.
And again, for a lot of areas in life, I think that's what all of us struggle with from time to time.
Uh-huh.
Worrying about the past versus the future and trying to stay in the moment, as you mentioned. And when I work with our soccer players, I try and help them stay in that moment, as I said. Very tough to do. It helps them with mistake management. And we know that athletes that start focusing on that goal of beating someone else, if they do too much of that, and if they do it too soon, they're more likely to burn out. If they have a good, healthy component of trying to make themselves better, it turns out that they will persevere. They'll be able to seemingly work a little harder, a little longer, and just put that extra effort in. Now, at the highest level, and you mentioned professional athletes, at the highest level, and at some point as our youth athletes develop into their adolescence and beyond, you'll find a lot of very good, very talented athletes that have lots of both of those components. And in the literature, this gets referred to as an ego goal orientation, or I'm trying to beat someone else, and a task orientation in terms of I'm trying to get a little bit better at this as I train. And the highest level athletes will have a good, healthy dose of both of those things because they are certainly trying to beat other people, and that's why they're there, to win. In our youth games, yes, winning can't be everything. And if we're going to develop athletes, we're going to have to put them in some situations where they experience some adversity and let them learn from that. We're going to have to let them play against stiff competition. Coaching, we'll have kids play short-sighted, so to speak, so we'll have them play a short game of 4v6. And let them learn from that on both sides of that game.
We are halfway through the program. You're listening to Line 1, your health connection. Our local number is 550-8433.
Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. Our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. We're going to take a short break, and then I want to come back and talk about some kind of ancillary issues related to sports, as bullying, which may not come to mind, some issues related to that's been in the news a lot recently about abuse of athletes, and also some efforts, some evidence about activity in the classroom and improving learning, as well as some of the deeper aspects of sports psychology. So after this short break, we'll rejoin my guest, sports psychologist Dr. Max Trenary. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage. If you missed part of today's program or would like to listen again to Line 1, Your Health Connection, the program repeats tonight at 7 on FM 91.1. Remember, tonight's rebroadcast is recorded and will not be taking phone calls. You can subscribe to free podcasts of Line 1, Your Health Connection on our website at alaskapublic.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
Welcome back. This is Line 1, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage, and I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Today we're discussing various aspects of the psychological aspects of sports with Mayo Clinic sports psychologist Dr. Max Trenary. You can email your questions to us over the next 30 minutes at line1@alaskapublic.org. Our local number, 550-8433. That's 550-8433, and our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And just remember, if you're listening between 7 and 8 on Monday, you're listening to a rebroadcast. We won't be able to answer your questions at that time. Dr. Trenary, let's relate bullying to talking with a sports psychologist. How do we put those two issues together, and what's important for us to learn about that?
Yeah, very, very tough issue that does come up here and there, unfortunately. And I've seen this in some teams where some athletes try and take charge, so to speak, and try and have their own way. And what I've done with that, and some of my colleagues have done with that, I know a coach in Stillwater, Minnesota, that's Phil Johnson, is an excellent teacher and coach, and utilizes some of these techniques as well. And what we'll try and do with that is set a team culture up early on. And I've talked about this through work at Mayo as well. And if we set up values for the kids and ask them what, not directly what their values are, but ask them in terms of how do you want to be remembered, how do you want to be known when your friends get together, you know, 5 years from now, 10 years from now, how do you hope they think of you? And I think that we'd all be very impressed with the kinds of descriptions kids will come up with, from 12 years old through under 23 semi-pro players that I've worked with. They'll come up with words like dedicated, I want to be thought of as caring, honest, kind, hardworking, and they'll write these things down, and again, they'll come up with these kinds of values that they weren't necessarily aware of in themselves until, as a group, they write this stuff down. And that starts to set up a team culture, I think, so that you can come back to that if there's some behavior within the team that is inconsistent with that. So you can have a discussion then with players if it needs to come up about the team culture and team values, and use that in training sessions, again, regardless of sport. And I think it helps add to some team cohesion that actually prevents bullying before it has a chance to get going.
Okay. Another issue that I'd mentioned before we went on our break is this issue of a lot of high-profile accusations of sexual abuse and even really seriously physical abuse of players, involving coaches and players. And I'm a little bit concerned that parents may be hesitant to allow children to participate in athletic pursuits and similar activities. Is that reasonable? And then are there ways that we can alleviate those kinds of concerns?
Well, I can understand the concern as well. I think it's only natural if you're a parent, and I think that there are ways that we can alleviate the concerns. Having some basic ground rules for everyone to follow and everyone to understand before practices ever start is one thing. And I think some of those things are pretty straightforward. Make sure that you always have two of the responsible adults. Maybe it's a coach and an assistant coach. Maybe it's a coach and a team manager around any time that there are kids there. So that means that there are those two adults that hang around until the last athlete is picked up. So if the last 10-year-old is there 10 minutes after practice, that means that those two adults get to stay around for 10 minutes, 15 minutes, whatever it is. And that way the child isn't left alone with one person ever. I also ask parents to not just drop their child off at the training facility or the training ground, wherever it may be, and just leave. I've had times, there was one day a few summers ago when a parent was going to drop their child off, and I basically flagged down the car and said, "Would you please hang around for a little while, because you're the only one here, and I prefer that you not leave your child here alone with me." And that's for everyone's protection. That's to make sure that there are just no misunderstandings later on.
Right.
That parent was especially surprised when I sat on the car hood. But it worked. The other thing I think we've got to do is have the associations that our kids are enrolled with, whether it's a baseball league, a tennis facility, soccer league, whatever. My preference would be that any adult having contact with the children go through a background check. And there are firms that can do this at different levels, anywhere for a few dollars to, a more extensive and expensive background check. But I think here in Minnesota we're paying, I can't remember what it is. It's something like $5 or $10 per coach to get a pretty good background check to make sure that they don't have some kind of record indicating that they shouldn't be around kids. So if we do those things and make sure that, one, we've got two responsible adults around, and then, two, those adults have background checks, I think that we can provide a safer environment for all the athletes.
I remember recently reading that some of the school districts in North Carolina have mandated that periodically during the school day that kids must get up and move around a little bit. And the rationale was that there's some evidence that will improve learning in particular. You have comments about that? Are you aware of this kind of information and research, and does it make sense?
Well, it makes sense to me. I can't say that I've reviewed every bit of that. I know that North Carolina has done that for their school systems. Here at Mayo, more and more there's been some advocacy for the standing desk. And there are around the institution a few desks that are actually set up on a treadmill.
Oh, yeah.
So that you can walk. I haven't tried this one myself. So that you can walk while you're working at your computer, laptop, while you're reading, while you're dictating a note, something like that. And it does keep us active. And the research does show into our adult years that if we are sedentary, we are more likely to end up with disease and debility. Everything from cardiovascular problems to diabetes. Mm-hmm. So keeping people active is just going to be better for our health, period. And I think that it is going to help in the school setting keep kids a bit more alert and engaged.
All right. Let me remind listeners once again, my guest today is Mayo Clinic sports psychologist Dr. Max Trenary. If you've got questions or comments, our local number 550-8433. Our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. I'm going to try to kind of stay on this idea of a little bit higher level of sports for the next 15 or 20 minutes as we end the program. So let's try taking this sports psychology advice since we've got you captivated here. If I were to ask you the question, what separates great athletes from those who don't make it, who burn out, or, well, don't worry about the injuries that prevent people from making it, but how would you answer that question?
Tough question. You're good at this. Yeah, we were talking earlier about the athletes that seem to persevere no matter what. And they seem to just work on through, and they will grind through their physical training. They will grind through the competition. And by and large, I think that these are people that do have that sense of wanting to be better themselves. They want to perform the sport activity and just get a little bit better at it to know that they've improved for themselves. They still want to win. And again, that's why the professional athlete is there. They are there to be at the top of their game and perform better than the competition. But they have learned along the way, I think, this need to improve themselves, and they have, I think, probably learned and acquired this sense of joy for the game, so that they simply love it. Now, I don't know that that is true of every single professional athlete at the top of their game. Once in a while, I've heard stories of even professionals who said that they played the game because they felt guilty because they had to.
Mm-hmm.
And so it doesn't mean that you can't go far with that kind of a motivational set, shall we say. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that you're going to get the most out of that athlete. Mm-hmm. I don't think that they're going to perform at the highest level. There are stories in the news, there have been currently, there have been in the past, about coaches who are very abusive, they seem to, push and, shall we say, whip their athletes along, driving them to perform. And I always have to believe that they would get so much more out of their athletes by providing them with more of a positive environment that we've been talking about today.
There are a couple of mental aspects to the sports performance that we haven't really addressed. We talked a little bit about mistake management. Goal setting, we've kind of talked around. Can we ferret that out a little bit more from your standpoint?
Yeah, they do go together hand in hand, and dealing with goal setting is difficult, I think, especially for young athletes. And I'll talk to them about this idea of specific, measurable, attainable goals. And then they've got to be relevant and time-bound. So we talk about SMART goal setting. And a lot of us, when we try and set out for an activity, may have a hard time saying when we have reached a goal. And I talk to athletes and work with them to develop very specific goals for their training so they know when they've hit the ball the right way. so they've got to be specific enough to make it measurable. And then the attainment part of this is really a key for our athletes. The research on this shows that even the elite athletes will set their goals at what I call consistency and development levels. So they always want to do what they do very well and be consistent in that. I've run a few marathons, and for me a consistency goal is just getting to the starting line with my shoes tied. But if you do that, you're off to a great start. A development goal in that same context would be getting my time down below a 7:30-mile pace. Once in a while I can do that, or I used to be able to do that. That was a while ago. But that kind of thing would be a development goal for a runner. It doesn't happen very often, maybe 5 times out of 10. And it's not as often as being able to just perform that activity on a consistent, regular basis. And so even the elite athletes set their goals at that kind of level and then have a few goals set clearly higher above that. And when I work with adolescent athletes, a lot of them will guess that the elite athlete has all high-level goals. And as we discuss it, they realize pretty quickly that if even the elite athletes or if they, the kids I'm working with, set their goals that high, it's going to be a pretty lean reinforcement schedule, shall we say. They're not going to get very many rewards out of that because they're not going to achieve that goal very often. So having the goal be attainable, still challenging at times, but attainable is really important because that just adds to their sense of being competent and their sense of being able to overcome some adversity and learn from it. And hopefully we give them those chances to do on their own as much as possible.
Another area that I think is could be helped by psychologists, maybe has a mental aspect, and that's motivation. And I know there's maybe not any magic answers to motivation, but if you're going to improve as an athlete, you need to practice, and you need to practice correctly, and you need to maintain that motivation to make yourself want to practice. And I can see the problem by saying you have to win, you have to win, you have to win, is not as motivational in the long run to me as saying I'm going to try to be the best I can be. How can I master? How can I improve? You know, myself, not relative to anybody else, then that may make it easier for motivation. What other ideas, or is that correct, or what kind of motivational environment, so to speak, will help keep kids and even advanced athletes going?
Yeah, and when I start working with athletes, the first thing I do, and I mentioned this earlier in a different context, but the first thing I do with them is start working on their values. As a group and individually. And at the same time, I work with them on realizing when they become unfocused. Because even in training in a game, they may not realize when their mind has wandered off. So one, we do value development just as I described earlier. How do they want to be known? How do they want to think of themselves? Even years from now, when they look back, how do they want to be? So if we can establish that, and then through mental skills training, what I'll do is work with them, and I know I have colleagues in sports psychology do the same thing, work with athletes on focusing their attention. I like to do that through relaxation training, not so much to get the relaxation out of them and teach them that, but to teach them when their mind has wandered off, because we do it all the time. A lot of the athletes think that they have to control their minds. The difficulty is the more they try and control their mind, the harder it gets to control it. And so by teaching them, one, values, and two, when they become unfocused, we can start to teach them what they want to focus on, namely their values. That's boiled down pretty quickly. It usually takes an hour or so to go through that with a group of soccer players. So we've got to teach them that and then bring all of that into their goal setting, because those values are going to drive their goal setting. Once they get into that, I think a key word that really is shown in professional athletes, shown in athletes who are trying to get to that next level, and I see in a lot of the adolescent athletes I work with, is the idea of willingness. Because they have developed some sense of themselves. They are motivated not just extrinsically because of wanting a trophy or something like that, but they do have that internal drive and hopefully enjoyment of their game and activity, so that now they're willing to experience some adversity. And again, if we give them the opportunities to experience the adversity, and as parents and coaches, for example, we don't treat them any differently. Mm-hmm. We still enjoy them. We still appreciate them. They can get through that adversity and still feel cared about and feel like they've got all the choices to make that they want.
Another topic I'd like to briefly talk about, and I'm sure there could be a whole program on it, is this idea of mental imaging and visualization. And I also want to take it to some of the stuff I've been hearing recently, where people will say an athlete can obviously practice physically a maneuver, but if they think about it while lying in bed at night, visualizing how they're going to do something, how they're going to hit a soccer ball, how they're going to swing a golf club, baseball bat, or whatever, just visualizing as close as they can, there's some evidence that may also activate the same neurons, the same pathways again, and maybe can improve the function of these activities. So it's a big subject. We only got a couple minutes left, so to speak. But how would you comment on this mental imaging? Where are we with this in reality?
Yeah, I use imagery in the work I do with athletes. A lot of sports psychologists do, and as you mentioned, there is good evidence to show that imagery actually activates the same brain pathways as the actual motor behavior. So striking a soccer ball will activate certain brain regions, and the athlete using imagery will activate those same brain regions. So that maybe makes it real or seem real, because now we have functional magnetic resonance images of the brain working, so to speak, when the athlete is lying and relaxing and going through their imagery routine. And it really does seem to work. It's effective. Some of the original sports psychology work was done with mental imagery for free throws in basketball. And the athletes who practiced mentally had a great improvement and looked pretty good compared to the people who had been out on the basketball court. So the stuff does work. And one of the other issues with imagery is that it's not just visualization, because imagery needs to involve all our senses. So it needs to involve the kinesthetics or the appreciation of posture, of what the muscles feel like, of the visual imagery, of course, but also the auditory imagery.
Mm-hmm.
That comes up with this. And I try to incorporate all the senses when I work with athletes. And in a way, one, you're doing mental practice to try and get better and to learn a skill and to rehearse it. The other thing that we're doing with that, I think, many times, is desensitizing the athlete to the situation, because we can mentally put them in adverse situations and walk them through it and have them cope with it without being there right away. And so we can go through, shall we say, this graduated process of having them become more comfortable or tolerant of the adversity. Mm. So we can accomplish a lot of things with that as sports psychologists.
So what I heard you saying is that, for example, if we were taking a soccer player and you wanted to use this mental imagery to help improve the a particular move or something, let's say hitting a soccer ball, is you have the athlete kicking a ball, for example, and when they kick it really well, you're asking them to really, what did that feel like? What did it sound like on that hitting your foot? What was the extension? Did you feel yourself extending your leg further? All these things. And so when you go to bed later or you're sitting in the locker room afterwards, you try to refocus, reimagine, and visualize all those kinesthetic senses, as you said again. And there is evidence that that by itself will increase the likelihood of increasing that performance in that particular skill.
Yes, well said. Again.
So wow, that's and again, it's because we now can see that we're activating the same neural pathways, and we know if you are a concert pianist, your certain neural pathways are just bigger because they got used more. So the more we use these pathways, the faster and the more accurate these pathways work. Just to get into the neurophysiology a little bit.
Sure, and that will happen, and that gets back to the idea of practice doesn't necessarily make perfect, but it will make permanent.
Yeah.
We want to make sure that the athlete is practicing the right way, and that's one of the slightly concerning things about using imagery that I have is that I can't see what the athlete's doing when they're doing their own imagery.
Right.
So I like to see, for soccer players, I like to see them go through it myself and then work with them from there. This is training that is used in England and other countries. You can do this kind of thing with teams. One of my favorite sports psychology sessions to do is pantomime soccer with a team of six passing a ball around and juggling the ball. And what happens is that their juggling per se doesn't necessarily improve, but because they are now focused on each other, they are engaged in some imagery to see where each one of them is moving and how they're moving. And one of the problems in that game, of course, is that people start to watch the ball instead of each other. And if they start watching their teammates and how their teammates move, and they're aware of each other, they're engaging in some imagery, and they'll go out and play better.
We're in our last minute, and the other thing I would like to point out as we learn about neurophysiology is that the earlier we learn these things, so the corollary of this is learning it right the first time and then continue to, you know, practice it right. So starting early is an important corollary that we really didn't get into too much. Is that also true?
It is, and we want, you know, we certainly want kids to have the chance to start early and to maybe try a lot of different things. You know, I'll mention that there are things out there, you know, some popularized by Malcolm Gladwell based on research that Erickson did, and it's this idea of the 10,000-hour rule. I was at a meeting with soccer coaches in Boston a couple of weeks ago, and this came up, and one of the things I emphasized to him is that no six-year-old went in the backyard with a ball thinking about 10,000 hours.
Right.
They went out there for the sheer joy of it.
Mm-hmm. And if they have the right motivation, they may get 10,000 tries in there.
Yep, and it's our job to come up with that environment for them.
My thanks to today's guest, Mayo Clinic sports psychologist Dr. Max Trinneri. If you want to continue conversations like this, you can join KSKA on Facebook, and you can find that link on our website, alaskapublic.org. Next week's program will be a recorded version of an interview I'm doing with ABC News Nightline correspondent John Donvan on autism. Mr. Donvan is researching and writing a book on autism that is an extension of a 2010 Atlantic Magazine article he has written with Karen Zucker called Autism's First Child. The live interview will be at the Alaska World Affairs Council program Friday, April 12th at the Hilton Hotel here in Anchorage. Because the program will be pre-recorded, we won't be taking phone calls. If you're interested for more information on this program or would like to attend it, go to the Alaska World Affairs Council.
Of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.